Check, check, 1, 2. Mic check, 1, 2.
Mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2. Doing these things like young dudes do. No, wait. Oh. See, he won't let me fly. He won't let me fly.
Go ahead, man. No, that's good.
That's good.
I love you too much to let you just do that to yourself.
Check.
Dynamic voices for a diverse church. This is Pass the Mic.
Greetings and God bless. Welcome to another episode of Pass the Mic. Dynamic voices for a diverse church powered by The Witness, a Black Christian collective. I'm your host, Tyler Burns. You can follow me on Twitter at Burns23. Follow at your own risk. And joining me as always is the president of The Witness, the man, the myth, the legend, Mr. Blue Check Verified himself, Jamar Tisby. What's up, brother?
Going back to my boxing days, I got to defend Perry Dodge.
Did y'all know Jamar was a boxer? Did y'all know that?
Champion boxer.
He's a champion boxer. I've seen no evidence of that, but I take him. I'm just going to believe him. I'm just going to believe
him. I can tell you the whole story, dog. I'm a champion boxer in my weight class, welterweight.
Okay, anyway. Bouts.
Money went to support missions in India. Come on now.
Wait, look, what?
I'm just saying, it's for a good cause.
You fought for missions
we
in India?
We fight.
So for missions? Like it was like a boxing tournament for missions?
It was a fundraiser, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So just was this like sanctioned, or was it like you and your homies just got together and like...
We were in the dorm room, yeah, just in the quad.
Touching each other.
No, it's huge. It was one of the biggest boxing tournaments outside of the military academies. Really, only the military academies today maintain the tradition of teaching boxing at the undergraduate level. And so Notre Dame has it. It's this huge boxing tournament called Bengal Bouts. And it's not a year-round thing. You do training twice a year, and then it culminates in a tournament. And so I fought welterweight my first year, competitive boxing entering the tournament. I got second place. And then the second year, my senior year, I got first place.
Wow. How many people did you beat?
It was from prelims, quarters, semis, and finals. So four.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you ever think about doing more with that?
No.
It's not, you're not about that life.
Nah.
Huh? Yeah, smart man. Smart man. No, this is crazy. Okay, so this is the type of thing we're going to get into with the AMA.
Word.
And we're here in D.C. D.C., what's happening?
They sound tired, yo. That's the itis. We just ate.
Right. They're like, eh. Yeah, so low-key turn up here in D.C., but
we got some sophisticated folks in here, you know.
But yeah, so we're gonna do a little AMA, and we're going to do this a little bit different. So we're actually going to allow you to raise your hand and speak, ask your question, whatever you guys want to talk about. We know nothing about what you're going to ask.
We know nothing what you're going to ask.
So we just flow in here. This is family
reunion.
We
can't even pre-screen them, like, when they text in the question.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
No, it's funny, because the first time we did have one of these pop-ups in Memphis, if you go back and listen to the Memphis AMA, we pre-screened the questions, and it's not that we don't want to answer anything. It's just that we don't have time to answer everything, so we just want to answer the core questions. And so I put a stack in my left hand of questions that I was not going to answer.
The goats.
And then I put a stack in my right hand of the questions sheep. That I was going to answer. And then I handed the left hand to Jamar. So I got asked all the questions.
Gave me the left hand of fellowship.
So I got asked all the questions, and I'm like, why did I... Like, I'm looking at him like, it's not the right one. Anyway, that's just a little insider for the people who actually listen. But anyway, what are your questions? I want to hear this. Let us have it. Last stop of the tour. D.C., y'all ain't shy. I heard y'all. Let's do it. It can be anything.
I have a question.
Okay, yeah.
Were you ever in a fraternity?
Yes.
Do tell.
Yes, indeed, I was.
Okay.
It wasn't Divine Nine, but at Liberty University.
No, it wasn't.
I would actually say you wouldn't have survived what we did to each other. Okay, Jamar, Mr. Boxer. I didn't rag on your story. Okay. Let me live my truth. Okay.
You didn't let me freestyle. I'm just saying. No. Go ahead, but tell us about it.
Yeah, so it was a fraternity called Alpha Nu Psi. And one guy who was the most famous member of the fraternity is a guy named Rashad Jennings. He actually won Dancing with the Stars. He was an NFL football player. And so we were both in a fraternity at the same time. I was a pledge. Why is that funny?
They were laughing at my face.
That's not funny at all. Like Rashad might listen to this and he might
I'm all respect to Rashad. Look, he's throwing signs.
So, hey, look, we had signs. We had step team. We had the whole nine. But it was fun, though. Adam knows it was kind of a weird group because it was like supposed to be you're not supposed to have a fraternity at Liberty, but we had one anyway. And so we had to do certain things to haze or put people through like the whole vibe of what you do that was not as extreme as like a regular college. But at the same time, there were challenges. So one of the challenges there's like a monogram. It's like a mountain. It's like a mini mountain. It's really like a hill, a steep hill. And they made us climb that at like 5 a.m. for like 5 hours blindfolded. Oh. So like we did that blindfolded. Oh. That was like one of the things we did. Another thing we held our hands together and they duct taped us for 24 hours. And so we had to basically figure out like how we were going to get around. And
so administration's not aware of this. Like, look at those guys. Their arms are duct taped. That's
I mean,
normal.
it was just two at a time, so it wasn't like you could like cover a sleeve. Oh, okay. And like it looked like we were holding hands. So it was like super sus. And
yeah, that might be worse at a particular college or university.
Yeah, I mean, so we had to figure out how to use the bathroom and eat and all that, like duct tape together. So.
Whoa.
Yeah, so but we did a ton of community service, leadership development, growth. It was dope. It was dope, and I appreciate
that's
those
impressive.
Brothers.
I'm always discovering new things about Tyler. That's all. It's a beautiful thing.
Mm. Wow, that's a great question. So the question is, Nally from Niceville, Florida. Man, shout out to Florida. I like that, man.
Florida.
This is energy up in here, man.
Okay, but we got some receipts on Florida. Florida right
you got
now.
Got receipts on every place.
Right now.
Every place got receipts.
Like right
every
today.
Place, every place got receipts on it. But her question was, you know, I mentioned that if there was one thing I'd probably do differently, it would be go to a different college. Where would I go? Oh, man, that's a great question. It probably would be Howard. I'd probably go to Howard. Yeah. Did you go to Howard?
No.
Oh, what? Oh, you went to, like, you don't like Howard? Like, what's that?
No, that's just what they do.
Oh, okay. See, I didn't know. I'm like, Okay, Howard Hand. Okay, yeah. So I actually have, I'm a youth pastor, and so I have a group of kids. A couple of them actually are at Howard right now. And so I'm kind of vicariously living through them. And so they're doing the Howard thing, they're doing the HBCU thing, and I'm loving it.
There's something about that, right? Like my first graduate history course was at Jackson State University, which is an HBCU. And the vibe on campus was here's what stuck out to me. As a black person, I didn't have to constantly think about being black. Hmm. So that was a brand new experience for me because now I really could dig into, well, who is just Jamar? Not the black man in America trying to maneuver people's racism. Now here, most everybody's black. So, okay, we've got that level ground, right? Okay. Now, are you in engineering? Are you into comic books? Are you into sports? Are you into chess? Are you into history, economics? Now you could just be free. Now you could just do you. Hmm. And it's not like we forgot we were black, but it was almost celebrated, right?
Yeah,
you know, it wasn't a problem, right? it was finally something that we could embrace and sort of express in ways we couldn't do within the broader culture. So shout out to HBCUs. I mean, they're doing vital, vital, vital work. Yeah. Have been and still are.
Yeah, I think so. The broader answer to the question is it would probably be HBCU. Yeah, that's the broader answer. Yeah. what's the deal here? What's the issue?
He went to Hampton. Where you go?
Where'd you go?
I went to the University of Maryland Eastern Shore.
Okay, okay. Got you. Okay.
I love it. I've
stepped into a whole debate. Yeah. That's one of those things you step in general. And people are swinging and you're like, oh, I'm going to go over here.
We had more fans coming in than we were going out. That's right. Okay.
He just want to go to Howard. He saw it on TV.
So here's a question for you, Jamar. What would you say is a book you've been doing a lot of research for, your book, The Color of Compromise, which I had to put up because people were going to swipe. But what would you say are a couple of books that have been really meaningful for you in your research that you've read that are maybe primary texts or maybe something that people might not have read or know about that have really rocked your world?
Specifically related to the book or just sort of,
you know what, I mean, book and then broader historical study that you're doing.
Yeah. There's a book by Matthew Lasseter called The Silent Majority. And he basically debunks the idea that it was this top-down approach by Nixon to adopt a sort of Southern mentality and discourse in his campaign. And he says, actually, that was a grassroots thing. They were doing that for a long time. It was just sort of the presidential administration caught up to what was popular. And he goes further. He talks about the idea of the Sun Belt. And I find that a really powerful idea because it's not just Southern. What happened was there was a white Great Migration in a sense in the 30s, right? And so you have folks from the Deep South moving west, and they're going to places like Texas, and then especially Southern California, but also, you know, other areas like Phoenix and whatnot. That's where Barry Goldwater is in Arizona, right? And so you get this spreading out across from coast to coast, really. You can count, you know, Charlotte, you can count Atlanta, you can count all these big cities. And so that mentality, it was more of a class and a suburban mentality, which is wrapped up in whiteness. So he's not discounting race, but it breaks us out of, oh, it's just the South that's racist. No, there's this Sun Belt thesis that he's proposing that I think is really helpful, because how do you get ultra conservative folks who sound exactly like folks in, like, you know, Deep South Alabama, but they're in Orange County, California, right? That's how you get a Saddleback Church, is this homogeneity of a suburban, you know, identity that is very racially homogenous, very economically homogenous, and very ideologically homogenous. And that, you can find that everywhere. So that was one really helpful book. Another paradigm sort of shifting book was Tom Sugrue, S-U-G-R-U-E, Origins of the Urban Crisis. And there are a lot of books in that genre, but it's just talking about how did the inner city become what it is. And so he's talking about, you know, redlining. He's talking about discrimination. He's talking about racial segregation, all these things. A much more accessible book because it's shorter and sort of written in everyday language is Ira Katz Nelson's When Affirmative Action Was White. And so we talk often about the New Deal and the GI Bill and how that was sort of distributed in racist ways. So he walks through that in a really short, accessible book.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Y'all write this down. I was like, whoa, I hope somebody wrote that down. Wow. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that's a great question. I think the question is, and I should repeat it for the audience who's listening, but John asked, how existential has it become for us in terms of our faith and questioning certain things about our faith, or kind of rethinking whether or not we believe the same things that we had before? I would say a lot of that is dependent and determinative on your proximity to the white evangelical church. And so if you are proximate and close to the white evangelical church, I've seen that there's maybe a little bit more of an existential wrestle there than if you have really deep roots in Black church and other forms of church expression that are in the American context and globally. I've seen personally the questioning more so of how my faith was formed rather than what I specifically believe. So the formation of faith was drenched in private Christian school, independent fundamental Baptist / SBC thought. I'm just trying to uncover everything, you know? So it was kind of all that. First it was independent fundamental Baptist, that's how I learned the faith outside of my father teaching me, which was not Baptist at all. That's how I learned the faith when I went to a school that for 8 hours a day hid that from me, hid my heritage from me, hid the contributions of Black people to the faith from me. So that was my initial part, which led to a lot of self-hate. And then transitioning to an environment where it wasn't as much self-hate, but it was required assimilation, forced assimilation. So I'm now going back and excavating how my faith was formed. Like, so who has impacted me, and why do I repeat what they say over, why do I look at my home church with suspicion? Because they're not, you know, liturgical in the same way we are. And because they you know, are charismatic. And so there's different ways in which they express the faith. There's different categories. There's different expressions of their service and emotional attachment to what is being preached. So all those things, that's mainly been the existential. And actually, that's led to a little bit of tension. I've mentioned this before with my family as far as what they allowed me to be immersed in. When they saw I was kind of falling headlong into the self-hate, they were like, no, racism is actually real. And I'm like, yeah, but it's too late now because I have all these resources. And if unless you give me resources that refute all this, I know all the arguments because I'm 17 now, I'm 18 now, I'm 21 now. And they gave me all the arguments to refute you. And so now I'm saying, why didn't you grab me earlier? Is public school that bad that you felt I had to stay in a place that was going to teach me to hate myself? And so that's how it's gotten existential for my family and I. And now my brother and sister, and I've talked about this before, I don't think they mind. My brother and sister are still in some of those environments in college now, senior and sophomore in college. And so now they're going through this, but much earlier than I am. Much earlier than I did. And so now I'm able to recommend resources to them that reveal kind of that invisible cloaking of all kinds of American exceptionalism and mess that's baked into the faith that they're hearing. So I think it's a wonderful question. That's how I'd answer it.
And I would, as we talk about this journey over the last year, I don't think I could highlight enough for myself how critical it has been to rediscover and discover resources from the Black church. And there are a lot of other really good expressions that I'm learning about. But for me, especially with the racial identity part, to go back to Black theologians, back to Black gospel songs, back to Black sermons, has been life-giving in a way that was never offered up as an option to me in my predominantly white Christian circles. So
yeah, I would say it's hard to leave the faith when you're around people who are so determined to hang on to it. It's very hard. Who no matter what is happening in the world, they are still, and this is why I think this is the place, I think, for emotion within the context of the church expression, is they're emotively praising God in the midst of cultural mess. And so it's very hard for me to come in and say, oh man, this election, I can't believe this and all this. And it's not saying that there's not a place for lament and there's a place for crying out to God and expressing the grief and the pain of what is happening in our country. But when you see people who are not just dealing with the intellectual argument, but they don't have health insurance.
Yeah.
You see people got laid off and they have no money. And they're the ones who are leading us in worship. It's hard to say, man, it's Christianity, anything I can't stand. I'm like, well, because what you're going through doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense why you're still hanging on to this faith and the intellectual and all the racism that you have to deal with every single day and all this and all that. But yet you're the first person who comes in. Okay, that's really hard for me to stay intellectual and academic when there's such great examples of living out your faith.
And for me, the existential difficulty has come in what communities I'm part of.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So what's been really painful over the past several years with police brutality, with the election, with the racism that's always been there, has been being sort of pushed out of communities that I thought I was a part of. Or realizing that those communities that said they accepted me only accepted a version of me that was acceptable to them.
And I actually want to say he walked through this. He's not going to go into detail. He walked through this a lot more seriously than you think. Like, I really want to acknowledge the pain of what you walked through. Like, you led us into that. And I'm proud of you. Like, because he walked through hell to get here. He lost a lot to get here. But anyway,
thank you for saying that. Yeah, and it's real. So
I was striving so hard to carve out a place, or as they say, to get a seat at the table. And God had to teach my hard-headed self in a very difficult way. There's other tables and there's other seats, and you need to build one. And the witness is part of building our own table, and the pass the mic is part of building our own table. And it's for people who want to have these discussions and who want to access Christianity in a holistic sense. That word holistic is so rich for me now, because in the theology I was learning, it was so segmented. There's the gospel and there's justice and never the twain shall meet. And I was like, what? This can't be true simply because of what I've experienced, let alone what others who have gone through much more than I have experienced, those saints you're talking about, right? I had to learn the hard way that in those communities, institutionally, which I would differentiate from individuals, but institutionally, it wasn't changing. Right. It just wasn't. And so I've said this often, when you are about race and justice and seeing progress, one of three things is going to happen. You're going to sell out, you're going to burn out, or you're going to get pushed out. So that's where I was.
Next. Listen, yo, so I have to say that this brother's shirt is incredible. You can't see it, but his shirt is Where Was All Lives Matter from 1619 to 1968, and I need that shirt in my life.
For reals. So, we got to get
anyway,
a picture.
I'm sorry,
after this.
Your question.
That was dope.
I'm sorry. So Chris is asking us our thoughts on a home-based church. You know, house churches. I praise God for them. One of the issues that I've seen is, and it's been acutely being now 9 years on staff at a church, is how much human metrics drive our presentation of the gospel. Human standards of success. How many people are in the seats? How much the offering is? You know, how many services we go to, our service times, the people who are coming in. It's a lot of distraction that goes into the everyday church experience. And what I found is that house churches and home churches are much more, I was actually talking to a brother over here, Amadi, who's talking about this reality of the organic expression of the faith, and how tethered are we to going to a building that we may be spending resources unnecessarily on, resources that maybe could be used to do some of the economic things I was talking about in the previous And you know, I think it's really difficult now because the American church has systematically, very slowly, but also very noticeably changed the taste buds of young Christians. And they've altered their taste buds to desire really catchy, really relevant, formulaic presentations of the gospel that center them rather than the kingdom, that center their experience rather than the community around them, that gets them to come in and have a great service with coffee in their hands, and the church is in a neighborhood that is suffering, but we can't engage with that suffering neighborhood because it would scuff up our shoes. And so how do we get to a place where we adjust that dynamic and remove that? And I think the house church is a beautiful place for that. I think it's difficult for me to speak on it because I'm in the Bible Belt. And so in the Bible Belt, everyone has a building. And if you don't have a building, you're not a church. And, you know, that's not biblical, but hey, I mean, you know, it's not biblical, but it's Southern. So, I mean, you know, so I would love to hear, and I'm actually learning and want to connect with those of you who are part of house churches and hear your experiences and your stories about how that's impacted your faith and influenced you to live out the gospel.
Amen. Yeah, I think the only thing I would add is...
You said amen. You can't say anything after that. Ain't no P.S. in God, brother. Ain't no,
it's black church. We say amen, and then we go on.
Once you say amen, once the prayer's out, we out. No.
I think, you know, every church model, if you will, has benefits and drawbacks. And so I think where people have critiqued, and probably unhelpfully because they haven't experienced the house church movement, is in the area of church polity. And so I would just look at governance and making sure that it's elder led and some plurality of elders, and that there's some accountability, whether it is an established
before
church.
I come out, y'all. Is it reformed? No.
Whether it's an established church.
That boy's still reformed. Y'all see?
We don't.
Somebody take a picture of him right now. Jamar Tisby is still reformed. No, no, keep going. I'm sorry.
Lord have mercy. Existential community issues here. But it's like, yeah, just as long as any church model can succumb to people wanting to be their own, form their own kingdom, right? Absolutely. And that's the issue, whatever church model we're talking about.
Absolutely.
For me, amen. That's all I'm saying.
Amen. Absolutely. So Taylor asked a question about women in ministry, and I'm going to kick it to Jamar.
Are you serious?
No. So I grew up in an environment, it's interesting because I grew up in an environment, this duality of taking in kind of a Baptistic theology. But at the same time, my church is extremely egalitarian. So my church expression is that women are able to do anything that a man is able to do within the scope of a service. And so that includes preaching, teaching. I grew up in that. And so my reform sensibilities when I was reformed, cage stage Calvinist, it rubbed up against a lot of people within the church the wrong way. And so I think one of the things that I've leaned into, and I talked about it in our misogyny episode, is if there's not women in ministry, women in my particular circle who are able to have authority to call out blind spots that I'm clearly exhibiting that I cannot see, then I'm going to just replicate the system around us. I'm going to replicate patriarchy. And so that's actually been something that one of the top accountability partners, she hasn't necessarily come into ministry yet, but I think she has that call, is my sister. My sister is 18 years old and very direct with me. And so we set up times where she can say, hey, you've observed me, you've seen me. And so now as you see me interact with people, what are some things that you're seeing about how I'm carrying myself around women? Am I using my power, using my privilege that I have to amplify the voices of women? One of the things that we've done within our teaching team in our youth group is it's predominantly women. And so I've tried to, as best as possible, give up as much of my teaching time to qualify women who are able to preach the word and teach and lead. Again, not a very reformed thing to do at all, but I think it's of vital importance. And I said this in the gender apartheid episode, the just because the black church is egalitarian, or some parts of the black church are egalitarian, does not mean they're doing better when it comes to misogyny. It's more than just positions, but it's also principles and it's also honor as well. And I think we can put people in. We use the idea, we hate when white evangelicals make us tokens, but we do the same thing to women. And then we pat ourselves on the back to say we're for equality, we're for dignity, for all, we're for all gender roles, we're all this. And the reality is we have a lot of skeletons in our closet. So,
and as far as reflecting on the last year, that's one of the biggest areas I think that we've been challenged to grow in, and hopefully by God's grace at some point be able to model really well, is respecting the image of God in women.
And we're going to do some stuff with the witness.
What did I say?
No, I'm saying, okay. And we're going to do some stuff with the witness.
Yes.
I'm okay. Teasing something that we're announcing in a couple of days.
Yes, yes. Okay, I thought I had slipped up and said something else.
No, but we're gonna try to make that concerted effort.
Yeah.
To center women's voices that you'll see soon.
And I mean, for me, it really came home at, I think it was LDR.
Yes.
We had a live recording with Truth's Table. And a young lady got up in front of a room like 60 people, which is very vulnerable with her experiences of patriarchy and misogyny. And she's basically asking, where do I go to feel safe? How is there anywhere I can just be a little girl and not have my body objectified or either repelled because men are afraid of the temptation? And I had no answer for that. It just rocked me. because it takes, it shouldn't be this way, but it takes women to have the courage to be vulnerable, to impact guys like me who just weren't aware, didn't take the time to be aware. And so it's painful. It's painful for me to realize I've been part of the problem.
Yeah, Truth Table has been massive. Like, yes. We're actually friends in real life.
Yes.
And they've been massive. Like, I think of actually one scenario. It was before, I think it was pre-LDR. And there was something that happened. And, it was pre-LDR. And there was something that happened. And, man, they got after us. They challenged us. And I remember I was like, man, they're so right. And I had to repent to them, and
because we weren't
stepping up. Yeah. Like, it was just, yeah, they've been massive.
So they're like actually knowing sisters. Women, yeah.
they've
helps.
Been
helps.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And look, yeah, and in these theologically conservative circles, it's like, yeah. You know, don't go near. It's, you know, which is dumb. It's dumb. Yeah. We don't have healthy friendships and relationships across the gender line. So of course. Yeah. Men are going to be jerks. Thank you. Good question.
Yeah, back in the back. Now, okay, so Matt asked the question, like, how do you take the principles of the Black church and the Haven and also the prophetic voice and implement that into a multi-ethnic, multicultural church? I just want to emphasize, though, that when Matt says he came from a Becca book, that is exactly what I was talking about. It is, I don't know how you are here, okay? You've gone through quite a journey. I want to talk to you afterwards and get notes and pray with you and have you pray with me. And I think it's important for us to glean and listen as much as we can. But I was talking with somebody recently about this idea that church comes basically, there's a church formula that is dependent on certain American suburban churches. There's a church form. There's a formula to how you plant a church. And not all of it is bad, but it is a formula that is dependent upon certain categories and certain qualifiers. And you have to ask the question, how have the steps that people are giving me, whether it's to go into a church, to integrate multi-ethnic people, diversity within a church, to hire leaders from the outside who are people of color, how has that formula and those steps been informed by white supremacy? And so what are the assumptions that you make in that place? So if the assumption is we're going to bring you in as a tool to use for the people who are here, well, then that's not respecting his dignity, his humanity. How do we make sure that we're not, I get this a lot. Hey, come in. Cause it would fit so good here. Why? For you, for me, which one? Or is it you're bringing me to the table, but you want me to sit in the kid's chair and you want me to eat, but you don't want me to set the menu, but it's good to have a kid at the table. And so I would say, like, how you present all of this, is it dignifying? And then also, does it name specific things? So sometimes what we do in diversity, especially with multi-ethnic churches, is we let the issues that would prevent this go unnamed to preserve the optics. The optics mean nothing if you don't address the root. So you got to put the axe to the root and say, this is why we have leaders on staff where people come. We got issues. We got problems. And you might not be able to say that in that way. You know what I'm saying? I wouldn't say, don't let me say it because it's not good. But I'm just saying, use wisdom, but you have to name it biblically. What are the issues that exist within our environment, within our church congregation, within our community that have prevented us, that have made this church predominantly white? And it's not just stylistic. It's not just preference, but there's some deep rooted sin here. So let us address the sin, even as we go and hire, use our money. And then let us allow them to come in and model. You have the opportunity now as a leader to model what it looks like to divest your platform to people of color and to say, we trust them to speak on this. I've had people say, come in, speak on race, but you have to tell us what you're going to speak on. Tell us all the things that you're going to do. Tell us this, tell us that. Do you want to say it like this? I'm like, whoa, like, that's not how we do it. And I honor the fact that they care about what's going on in their pulpit. That's not what I'm saying. But if you're giving me more scrutiny because of my topic, when, you know, you wouldn't give him the same scrutiny because he's going to come in and talk about sovereignty. Well, then, you know, we're revealing ourselves there.
So. I mean, it's very particular to your church and your community. So I don't know what it's like. And so I don't know exactly what it would take. I have found, though, that in churches that are predominantly white and theologically conservative, they just don't have the range. You won't be able to do it. You won't. Not without some radical steps that most people aren't willing to take. So that means going back. It means focusing on the process, right? Not just the process of, you know, planting and growing a church, but your own theological formation. Because you've been using categories that are going to be very foreign in different contexts. And it's just not going to preach. It's not going to speak to where they are. Not even just talking about Sunday morning. We haven't learned from the people who are informing the ones we want to bring in, nor have we
learned enough
about their situation, right? And been with them. And so the analogy, somebody was telling me recently, a pastor used this illustration of you're baking a cake. You get all the ingredients. You got your eggs. You got your flour. You got whatever else goes into baking.
I was about to say.
You know.
Do you know
butter. Butter. Right. Yeah.
We don't see what he does here.
So you put it all in there. You go in. You put it in the oven. It bakes out nice and neat. Put the frosting on it, all that stuff. You bite into it. It's like, you know what? I forgot the sugar. Now you try to go back and sprinkle some sugar on top and say, see, here, we got it. But the reality is,
come on, Doc,
it's not in the constitution of what you've created. So you can't just sprinkle it on top and say, now we've got diversity. It's been baked into the entity you've created. And I don't know the language that honors the undefeatable aspect of the church. Right? Like, I believe
yes
with all my might yes. in the church because I believe in Christ.
Yes. Yes.
And the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So I believe in the church. When it comes to congregations, though, you might, I mean, honestly, for some congregations, if you really want diversity, you got to dissolve the church and start brand new, like you just planted it. Like, there's no way to go back and fix it. There's no way to go back and put the sugar back in the cake when you didn't put it in the batter before it went in the oven to bake. There's no way to go back and put that in there. So,
wow. I love that statement. You haven't listened to the people who inform the ones you want to bring in. That's powerful. Wow. Yes, brother. So the question that Delonte asks is about John MacArthur and about the statement of social justice on social justice of the gospel. So basically he was asking, do we believe that John MacArthur set the white church back and has kind of pushed the white church back to more galvanizing around, you know, rejecting these kind of concepts, galvanizing around status quo?
I think anytime you have a leader as prominent as John MacArthur making statements, it's going to have an impact, right? His reach is monumental, even among black folks. I'm very surprised.
Even in South Africa as well.
Lord have mercy. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, he's catalyzed his ministry by packaging his teaching in such accessible forms, sermons and CDs and conferences and books. So it's out there. And he's got a large group of Christians who listen to him. I don't know about, you know, setting people forward or back, but I do think it has an impact in a couple of ways. One, it's deflating for people who were trying to push for more of a seamless integration of gospel and justice, which has a whole other conversation that they should even be separate in the first place as an assumption is not really a thing. I don't think I'm doing the Adam.
Was moving Keely his head. Here. Like I was like, Adam Keely here.
Anyway, So I think it's deflating to folks who were pushing for progress and have this really prominent leader come and say, nope, you're wrong. And here's my huge statement about that. But I think probably a more enduring and perhaps more damaging effect is that it emboldens people who already thought that way.
Yeah.
Because now here's this leader who so many people listen to and respect saying what we're saying. Now we've got words to it. We've got signers. We've got this whole moment where we can just amplify everything we've been saying before, so that even the people who were pushing against that kind of understanding / misunderstanding of the gospel and justice, their voices are now drowned out by the people who feel like they can more boldly proclaim it. So I think that's one of the big negative impacts of a statement like that.
Yeah, I think it cemented the people who were already going that way. But I don't want to understate or overstate its influence. I want to understate it because it does have meaning and it does have impact. But I don't want to overstate it in the sense that if you read the articles and you thought that was a strong theological argument that presented opposing views charitably, then I'm not totally sure if this wave is for you. If that's what's convincing you, I'm just going to be real. It was theologically light. It was drenched in cultural. So when we're talking about it, we're not even talking about, man, let's the reason why Jamar is saying, man, we don't exhaust ourselves in responding to this stuff, because it's not, it wasn't well done. I've heard better arguments against it. I've heard better arguments against us that we would take to heart. And we would say, oh, okay, well, I see where they're coming from. This was not that. And so that's what convinces you and pushes you into that. I'm kind of like, well, you may not be open to opposing views to begin with. And so it may just be a situation of cementing where you were already going. It doesn't mean you're without hope. It doesn't mean you're lost. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying you may be going in a direction that is totally different from the wave that we believe God is kind of pushing us towards. So
go ahead.
Okay, hang on. So there's a question. Bo asked this question because Jamar and I were having this conversation. I made a statement, which I will stand by and repeat. I made a statement that if you are asking me, what do I want to listen to? Is it hip hop from 1990 to 1999 or hip hop from 2000 to 2010? I said, give me the 2000s every day of the week. I would prefer to listen to the 2000s.
If you couldn't hear it on the mic, the audience was just like, what?
I absolutely stand by it. And I automatically know I'm arguing from the underdog position. I know I am. But what I'm telling you is, 2000 to 2010 shaped hip hop for the next 30 years. And it was extremely important. Specifically, hang on.
Let him speak.
Specifically, there are specific albums that shaped hip hop that come from 2000 to 2010, such as 808s and Heartbreak from Kanye West. That shaped. No. You guys, hold up. So what you're telling me is 808s and Heartbreak did not have decades-long impact on how hip-hop presents itself. That's what you guys are saying. Someone stand up and tell me that. And that was in 2000. That was in 2000, 2010. Exactly.
808s and Heartbreak is their first example.
I'm saying it had long, far-reaching impact. Not saying it was his best album, but it had far-reaching impact. Somebody stand up and tell me it didn't. This is the thing. Tupac, yes, I knew this was coming. So what you're telling me is you would prefer any Tupac album over any Kanye album. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
What? Really? Any Tupac album. Hang on. Any over any over My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, over Graduation, over College Dropout, over Late Registration. You would prefer it over all that. You prefer Tupac's catalog over Kanye's from 2000 to 2010.
Catalog, yes, absolutely.
Okay, we would disagree. There are five albums. There are five albums, 2000 to 2010. I'd take all those five albums over anything Tupac put out. Pre-MAGA Kanye, yes.
Hey, we were talking about how...
No. I'm tagging in Adam. And bring somebody else in. You lit a match.
No, you're doing great.
No, I just, 90s hip hop, man.
Look, let's just be honest. There's such a level of subjectivity to this, and music has an influence upon.
Oh, this is Aaron James, by the way. Yeah. By the way, this is Aaron James. Go ahead.
What's going on, y'all? So, Music has an influence upon us because we attach music to experiences that we've gone through in life at those particular times, right? And so we can't expect to bring a healthy level of objectivity to this conversation, right? And so let's just
Thank you, Pastor. Can we just be honest about that?
Thank you, Pastor. Let's just be honest. Because I'm with the 90s crowd, right? But I also realize, I mean, I was coming into my own in certain ways in the 90s. I'm from the Deep South, born and raised Louisiana. So I grew up on Ghetto Boys, 8-Ball, MJG, Outkast, when they were first coming out, watching them on BET after school, you know. And so it's different. Oh, yeah. And those, you know, No Limit, all those cats, you know, Mystical, Master P, you know, and just, you know. And so if you ask me if I think it's better... Man, yeah, you know,
exactly.
But a reason for that is I went to college in the Midwest, like in the North Midwest, and so, you know, I was hanging around a bunch of guys. They were onto Jay-Z and Wu-Tang, and I was like, "Who are these people?" And I was like, "Why do they rap so funny? Like this is offbeat. They can't even like what's happening?" And really, what was happening to me, I couldn't appreciate what they were doing, quite honestly. And so as I listened more, I was like, oh, no, this is pretty dope. You know, I mean, I grew to appreciate it. And so having said all of that, the 90s were better. Yo, come Fire on, away. Man. Come on. It was better.
Fire away. I mean, yeah, go off.
Some of these folks I can't even listen to because I got like a vocabulary and I can only understand.
You talking about 2010? No, you talking about 2010 and to now. You're not talking about 2010. Huh? Know what you're talking about? You're not talking about 2010.
Okay, yeah, because yeah, I was
2000 to 2010. Yeah, what I'm saying is it influenced the next wave of hip hop. How would you say it's a degradation?
There's always been
bad hip hop. Y'all act like ain't never been bad hip hop. How do you know what? How do you couch majority? Like you're pointing to me the greatest artist, and then you're saying that's the majority of the 90s.
Yeah.
How do you couch that? How do you prove that? That's an unprovable statement.
Hey, couldn't we say though?
I'm sorry.
What?
I'm
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go ahead.
There's two things that I think there's like really should be added.
Adam Keeley.
Ayo Keezy, don't follow me on Twitter at all. Not a joke. Two things I think should be added to this conversation. Yes, I am. But I want to speak to a bigger thing though that I think you hit on, which is objectivity. It's very hard to do generational spans of like understanding what is good, what is not. Someone who liked Saturday Night Live in the 80s when they were 25, I guarantee you they do not like Saturday Night Live now.
Yeah.
It's not for them now.
Yeah.
It was for them then.
Yeah.
Music is much the same way. You even see psychologically, we hit a taste freeze in our mid-30s where we no longer understand the new stuff that is coming out.
Hold on. Okay.
Because
okay,
it is not. No,
okay.
No. That's a real thing.
All right. All right.
That is a real thing. That is a real thing. That is a real thing.
Okay.
You could Google it.
Okay.
Let me finish.
All right.
Let me finish.
Hey, yo.
Let me finish. So wait, hold on. Let me just finish up. Because I'm gonna be real quick. But these are the things that we need to. These are the filters that you need to know. Like when you're 38 or 48, trying to listen to a 19-year-old talk about their problems, it's automatically gonna sound trivial to you. So you're automatically gonna have a negative connotation. So it's automatically gonna be harder for you to like it.
Sometimes it automatically sounds stupid.
Right. It does because you're grown. You know what I'm saying? You're grown. But wait, let me finish. Also, as we know, as time passes, only the good things remain, right? I cannot name to you the sixth man in the Orlando Magic in 1996. I can name to you the sixth man in the Orlando Magic in 2009 because it's only 9 years ago versus 20 years ago. You know what I mean? So our mind does the same thing. I can still remember that Lil Zane was making trash music in 2004. I don't know who was only around for a couple of years in 1994. We have all forgotten those people, and all that remains is the Fugees and whatever, whatever. It's not like that for the 20s. So these are filters that you also have to think of. Lastly, hip-hop now, I'm not the biggest fan of all the new rappers. Hip hop now is in a deconstructionist era. You see the same thing in painting. Painting was ornate. You went to the Renaissance. You went to the modern. And then it could not get any more technically solid. So people just started putting, you know what I mean? They started doing stripes on walls. That was all that was left to do because it could not get more technically complex.
So trap, right? Is that what you're...
That's what I'm saying. Okay. So when you talk about mumble rap, when you talk about these types of music, you're not talking about a falling back. You're talking about a plateau that is leading towards the next discovery. They're just on a plane. They're not moving backwards. They're on a plane. The staircase was like, oh, we got like hip, a hop, a hip it to the hip it. You had that flow. Then you had, you know what I mean? And then flows progressed and they got more complex and they got more innate and then they did multi-syllabic. And they did all these things, and then Drake comes in and he's singing on half the track and he's rapping, and then there's nowhere else to go, so they just start mumbling because that was all that was left to do. And then someone who is 7 years old right now, will take Curtis Blow, and they'll take Tupac, and they'll take J. Cole, and they'll take Lil Wayne, who he even mentioned Lil Wayne from 2010. What? Okay, that's an, I'm not going that way. But I'm not accepting that boo on Lil Wayne from 2010. I reject it. And then they'll take, you know, they'll take these mumble rappers and they'll take the culmination of that and then they'll get to the next wave, which will be a progression, which will be a Banksy of rap, which will be, you know what I mean, what it has gone to. So I just wanted to add those in because I think it's unfair. There's nobody in here right now who's 17, 18 years old who heart bleeds when they hear XXX, who, you know, is a problematic person. But when they hear mumble rap, there's no one here that is experiencing their first love who then hears LMA sing boot up and it screams to them because they're 17.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? In the same way. But I know, but I'm just saying, but so there's no one here to speak for that point. So it's an unfair conversation.
Yeah.
It's a slanted like trial level.
Yeah.
Nobody here is unbiased enough to tell.
But see, that's what I'm
saying.
That's the subjectivity of it, right? Yes. Music is experiential and it's deeply moving.
Why are Tyler and Jermaine neither on the mic at their show? I'm just like, why am I looking at Eric?
I don't know. I don't know why I'm looking at you. I don't know. I don't know. But we were having a similar conversation earlier though, right?
You don't have to tell them what we're talking about.
Yeah, man. It's
Don't tell them what we're talking about.
Yeah. There's such a level of subjectivity when it comes to music, and it's so tied. So, you know, if a certain jam was playing when, you know, you were all googly-eyed and weak in the knees, butterflies in your stomach, sure, looking across the room at a certain somebody, yeah, you know what I'm saying? You could be with a different person 25 years later, and that song come on, and you'd be like, I have to cast that thought down right now in the name of Jesus. Look, I rebuke you. Like, I will not go back. I mean, y'all laughing because you know what I'm saying? Right? You know what I'm saying? And so... And so that's the power and the influence of music. And so hip hop has been phenomenally evolutionary, and I definitely appreciate that. But within every progression in terms of music, it doesn't mean that there's a progression in quality. And so you have transcendent artists that, regardless of the time period, they can be appreciated regardless of who you are. You know, it's like you could be a younger person and get turned on to like Tupac, and they listen to it and they're like, oh my gosh, I never, like, you know, or just whoever. That's just an example, you know, or whoever it may be. But Lauryn Hill. Like Lauryn Hill, right? They're like, oh, I just thought that was the girl, you know, from the old movie Sister Act. But no. So much more, right? And so, but what we're talking about, we were making an argument specifically in qualitative terms.
Yeah.
Right?
And well, so, Tyler's making an influence.
No. That's right.
He was
right.
A preference.
Yeah.
He was talking about a preference.
And so, and here's where I think
and
we got mixed up.
And this is why I'm talking about the filters of the conversation.
We're making qualitative arguments when in reality, Tyler does have a point. I really do. Like, in terms of influence, you can't say that that's not true. Now, it may hurt us to admit that, but you can't say that the music that he produced didn't have a very real influence on the artists who came up after him, and that his influence was stronger than, you know, music that's separated by more time. So, yeah, absolutely. I get you that. Yeah.
And I will say that Tupac didn't really have that big of a musical impact. He didn't.
Who are you?
He didn't. People, there's not Tupac. If you trace, like, okay, for instance, let's take Lil Wayne. I'm not saying for the good or the bad. Wait, let me finish. But how many, when Lil Wayne started getting tattoos, when he started rapping and doing his weird stuff in his elevated state, how much of music...
Is that what we're calling
how
it now?
How much of music now is birthed from what Lil Wayne started doing? They took what he did and they did it to the next level. When Tupac passed away, no one carried the mantle of his style, his cadence, his musical content. You can't trace it past the point of him. It's like when Jim Brown got out the league or when no one else was trying to play like that. Nobody else, running backs weren't really influenced by Bo Jackson. He was a flash in the pan anomaly that we look to and we
what?
Yeah, running backs what? Okay, I don't want to add other conversations into this. What I'm trying to say is Tupac was an amazing rapper. I'm not saying that he's not top 3 of all time, top 2 of all time. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that he is an anomaly that stands alone. There's not a category of people that try to sound like Tupac or are learning from Tupac moving forward. That's
because
all I'm saying.
If you have sense, you don't try to replicate that. Huh?
We're going in a lot of different directions.
Look, I've taken so many notes.
We're
going to
let them come back up. It's getting late.
We got to deal with this Bo Jackson thing. We got to deal with this. We got so much work we need to do. Let's just go outside. Let's just talk about it out there.
Yes. So... we knew this was going to be special. We knew this was going to be different. Yeah, I think what's going to happen is this is a longer conversation.
Thank you guys so much for joining us. We really appreciate you being here. And all the opinions and the energy that you guys gave us is just amazing. This is what we believe Pastor Mike is about. Hopefully this is a safe space, free space for you to ask questions, to be who you are, and to connect with other people. Just the incarnational solidarity, that's kind of the word for tonight, I think is really important. And so hopefully this frees you. I think a key part, I know that's a kind of a joke, but we're having a fun debate or whatever, but it's good to be in a space where we're free to have those types of conversations, where we're not constricted to me preaching or you preaching or but that even our perspectives on art and common grace of people who may not even claim to be believers actually a point of reflection for us, and it's a point of intersection with our faith. So hopefully this has been an encouraging experience for you guys, and hopefully you've kind of got energized to go back into your local community and do what's necessary. And we can't thank you enough for just who you are and supporting us and coming to this show and spending your Friday night with us. I mean, we don't take it lightly. It's no assumptions on our end. Jamar and I have no assumptions. We have no assumptions that, everyone's just listening and everyone likes to listen. People are excited about the content. Like, we have no assumptions. We have no way of knowing outside of people telling us and encouraging us to move forward. Mm-hmm. So I honor you guys and thank you for being people that hopefully will continue all these conversations in glory. And when there's no time limit and there's no endless food at the table and all of that. So I'll kick it to you tomorrow.
Our mission is liberation. Y'all go and be free. Follow Jesus and do what you do.